order. Okay, we'll bring this in.
All right, we're going to call to order this meeting, the House Transportation Economic Development Committee. Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, February 23rd, 2012. We've got to focus on a couple issues this morning that are non-road issues. We've had a lot of road issue focus in other hearings this month, so we're going to focus on rail specifically and other non-highway transportation funding. So we invite up to begin Lynn Peterson, David Knowles, and Jim Cox. Proceed in whatever order you would like.
Good morning. Is it on? Co-chairs and committee members, my name is Lynn Peterson, Sustainability Communities. What is my title? Sustainable Communities and Transportation Advisor to the Governor. We just wanted to quickly go over. We've got David Knowles with C.H. Shum Hills, project manager from the consultant side, and Jim Cox, who's the project manager for the project on ODOT's side, staff. I just wanted to kind of give you a little bit of context, and then David will go over the process that we're just starting up. So this is both presentations this morning are mostly focused on processes that are about to begin or processes that are in midstream. So in no case do we have any definitive specifics to give you yet, so this is just more informational. The context for the Oregon passenger rail planning process that we're just beginning to start is really one of I-5 corridor capacity. And ODOT has been looking at this for quite some time. There's been several studies in 1994. And then in 2009, many years later, there was actually money that was provided by the federal government and FRA, which had been mostly regulatory in what they had been doing, suddenly had a capital infrastructure program for passenger rail. And they have been providing grant opportunities, which we have taken advantage of. But one of the things that we also took advantage of is some planning money, because in 2009 there was a bit of a study also to look at what the possibility would be to improve service by moving the existing Amtrak service from the west side of I-5 to the east side of I-5, which got a lot of people talking from one end of the state down to Eugene about what the possibilities, benefits, costs to doing that sort of thing would be. And out of that, ODOT went forward with a proposal to do a Tier 1 corridor analysis, a NEPA Tier 1 corridor analysis that David will do a little bit more explanation on. But really, it's to look at the alignment and have a open, transparent discussion about what the future alignment would look like from Eugene to Portland. And they did 100 interviews leading up to this process of stakeholders in the corridor and have found that many people look at this as an economic development tool. Whether it is for freight or passenger rail, the rail system is important to the future of Oregon. And it was so important to get community visioning done so that we know where to make investments and have it work for the long term that the governor actually said the advisory committee for this process would be a governor's task force so that we could be as open and transparent and make recommendations in an Oregon way because this is a federal process. We wanted to make sure that the Oregon discussion was included, the Oregon values were included, and we identified those as we moved along. So I'm going to turn it over now to David and let him go over the proposal as it's planned out.
Good morning. David Knowles with CH2M Hill. I'm the project manager for the Oregon Passenger Rail Program, working with Lynn and with the Oregon Department of Transportation. As Lynn indicated, there's really great promise for improving passenger rail service in the Willamette Valley. There's both the infrastructure possibilities and we have communities that really can benefit from enhanced service. The way that we're pursuing this is that the Federal Railroad Administration has granted money to the state to study how passenger rail service could be improved. We are using a process under the National Environmental Policy Act to develop an environmental impact statement. it's a pretty detailed and you might say rigid process in the sense of the way the rules work, but it's what it's really intended to do is to provide a framework in which a number of ideas can be evaluated and the community benefits can be looked at. The specific problem we're trying to address is that the existing rail lines and service within the Willamette Valley are not adequate to provide the kind of passenger rail service that is possible and for which there seems to be some demand in the communities between Portland and Salem. And so through this process, what we're going to do is look at different alternatives for dealing with the impediments to improve service. Some of those are deal with infrastructure. Some of those deal with the alignments themselves. The NEPA process will allow us to evaluate the problem we're trying to solve, that is to improve passenger rail service, and to look at a number of different alternatives for solving that problem. Lynn mentioned that this is intended to be an open and transparent process. That's both a federal requirement as well as the way we do things in Oregon. And so we're going to go through a pretty deliberate process of evaluating impacts and involving community input. I've provided to you this diagram of how the environmental impact statement process works. We're just at the very beginning of this process, and it lists a number of the detailed steps involved. I won't go through each of those, but as you can see, it is in a sort of traditional planning process, and we're pretty good at doing this outside of the NEPA process in Oregon, starting with a wide range of alternatives, using criteria developed by starting with the public and then developed by the Leadership Council, which I'll talk about in a minute, to evaluate those alternatives. There then are a very short list of alternatives that are looked at in some detail for costs and impacts. And finally, there will be a final preferred alternative selected. And that alternative could look like simply making some upgrades to the existing rail facilities on the UP or on the Pacific and Western. It also could look like a completely separate rail alignment. That's what this process is intended to do, is to identify those ranges and to get to a specific choice. Let me talk a little bit about the public involvement process, because this is a really important component of the planning process. The governor has appointed a leadership council that consists of citizens, representatives of the communities, elected officials, members of the legislature. It is serving as the body to which a lot of this public input will go, and they will, on behalf of the public, make recommendations to the Oregon Department of Transportation and in turn to the Federal Railroad Administration. The Federal Railroad Administration, under a federally funded process like this involving NEPA, is the actual decision maker. We are making recommendations to them. So we have to work very, very closely with them to make sure that the process we follow, the recommendations we make, are consistent with their expectations. And then finally, in terms of public process, I would just mention that there will be both corridor-wide opportunities for citizens to be involved, as well as specific segment advisory committees appointed and participating in this process. This is a process that's going to take at least 2 years, and so over the course of that time, there are going to be a number of these public opportunities for involvement. I think I'm just going to stop there in case there are any questions, or Lynn, if you think there's something else I ought to mention.
Jim, did we miss anything?
No, I think that's good.
Jim has been a great project manager internal to ODOT, with a mindset on allowing the public to actually help define the problem as well as the solution, which is, I think, the direction that Oregon Department of Transportation has been going, and something that is supported by all the partners in this endeavor.
Questions for this panel? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At what point during the process are you going to look at demand, or has that already been established?
Has not been established, and so one of the criteria for evaluating different ways to solve the problem will be what What is the potential ridership? What's the demand for service in each of these alignments or in each of these communities? So I can't give you a specific point in time, but that's one of the variables. Certainly demand, which depends partly on the travel time for the service. Travel time depends on the nature of the facility as well as the speed of the trains. And so there's a number of variables that really work together to determine how important the service is, what can be provided, what sort of changes are needed to make.
Can I just follow up on that? When we do the modeling, Representative, there's two different types of costs to somebody in the model, and one is travel time and one is out-of-pocket. So that then feeds into the demand ridership numbers. However, this general alignment discussion will not focus on specific station locations. It'll be kind of big blobs of areas on a map that would be general. So there's still a lot of work to do after this study.
Thank you.
Representative Bathurst.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In addition to travel time, we know that frequency and reliability are incredibly important. For example, if you had the choice of three or four or five trains you could travel from Eugene or Albany or Corvallis or Salem or wherever the stops are up to Portland quickly and easily, if there were choices, you may be much more inclined to choose one, whereas if the only option that exists is 5:30 in the morning, you're not very likely to use it, unless, of course, you had to be at a meeting at 7 a.m., which is not unheard of here. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit to how much the ridership increased between Eugene and Portland, even without additional frequency or better speed or better reliability.
For the numbers, we'd have to get back to you on the numbers, Representative. But there, it is true that the ridership has been steadily increasing, and maybe Betsy still here? Betsy knows the numbers off the top of her head. But it's been a steady increase in ridership as cost of fuel has increased over time.
The other thing I wanted to ask, if I could
please
do one follow-up. Could you please talk just very briefly about how, even though this is a discussion about passenger rail, how it's possible that certain kinds of improvements could end up making improvements for freight mobility and thus have additional economic benefit for the state?
I think one of the great opportunities is to use what on the surface may just be improvements in rail infrastructure to create economic development benefits in the communities that are served by these rail lines. And that'll be reflected. I think improved freight service is certainly one of the outcomes of this process and the improvements that will result. But so is the opportunity to take a look at the placement of the lines, the location of the stations, and the kind of spin-off benefits that can come from providing enhanced passenger service as well as freight service to the communities within the Willamette Valley. That's not necessarily a traditional focus of the Federal Railroad Administration. One of the things we're going to do, because this is what we do in Oregon, is we're going to be focusing on the community impacts as well.
Thank you.
Representative Whiter.
Thank you. This might be a little more for Lynn, but I'm just kind of curious what kind of oversight we're going to have on this with the project going forward, and if we have cost on doing this project all the way through, what's it going to cost the state of Oregon to partake in this? Because we're starting to see some things that are a little scary in the CRC that have been discovered by accountants, and I'm wondering if we're going to run into the same kind of boondoggle with this as well.
Co-chairs and representative, I would say that this is the discussion phase of a visioning process, not the end product of an engineering analysis moving forward into construction. I mean, we're at the very beginning of a discussion, and what's going to happen through this discussion is two things. are required by the Tier 1 analysis. One is a recommendation on a general alignment. And usually out of these things, it'll be a general alignment with a few, well, we still have to answer these questions as we move forward. But the second part is a financial analysis for the short term and the long term. So as we move through this process, everybody on the committee, and as you guys get updates, you will know, based on the scenarios that the public has asked for study on, because every reasonable alternative needs to be analyzed within the constraints of the purpose and need of the project, you will know the minimum and maximums. And that's the conversation that will happen over the next 2 years, is what are those minimums and maximum costs, and what benefits do we see from them? So I would say you're going to see that over the next two and a half years, and then when the recommendation goes forward, there'll be that implementation phase of, do we have enough money for the short and long term? And the two will start working together towards specific projects. And those specific projects could be as small as several million dollars in conjunction with the private side, if they choose an alignment that already exists. That would be a minimum.
Let me follow up,
please.
I think, I mean, something that would put me at ease a little bit, and it kind of goes with Representative Sheehan's question and where Representative Nathanson was going, but see what the numbers are going to be coming back, where ridership's going to be. Is this going to be self-sustainable, or is it something that's just going to be a drain on the ODOT budget because we're having to pay for this all the time because we're not going to have the ridership? So get an understanding of those numbers. And then when we do the RFP, make it very clear so we know exactly what we're paying and we're not getting into shelling out millions of dollars because, oh, we're changing this, changing that. But be very detailed up front, and that would be nice information for us to have before we went forward with this.
I think that there are a lot of lessons learned, representative, across the nation of that we can look at in 2 to 5 years when we would actually get to the point where we might be constructing something, about how to get at that exact issue, you know, the whole conversation about design build and what do you put in and the performance outcomes, cost accounting, all of that, efficiencies. Thank you.
Commissioner Bills?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell us again where you are on the milestones? I think you mentioned it, but I didn't catch it.
Well, we're actually somewhere to the left of that first star. So we're just starting. We do not have the formal go-ahead from the Federal Railroad Administration yet for the work program. So there's been a lot of work done to identify the process and to lay out what the public involvement steps are going to be, but we don't have permission yet to start using their money in full for the planning process. We expect that, we hope, within the next few weeks. So we're very close.
Please. So the amount that we expect would be of interest, and then I think you mentioned this is a two-year process. Is that what I heard?
It's at least 2 years. We're going to work very hard to make it a two-year process.
And how much are you expecting the federal government to give to this project?
So I think I'll let Jim address that.
Jim, if you could also introduce yourself for the record, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Benz, I'm Jim Cox with the ODOT Major Projects Branch. I'm the ODOT Project Manager. We have a total project budget of $10 million, which is split between $5.8 million of state funds and $4.2 million of federal funds through FRA.
Please, you bet.
And the focus of the study is the space between Portland and Eugene. Am I correct there?
Correct. We are looking at the space between the section of the corridor between Eugene and the Oregon border.
Vancouver, that border.
Yes, correct. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah. And the... I take it the money that's coming from the federal government is in the context of a broader discussion nationwide for this type of thing. Is that correct? Or is this Oregon, uniquely Oregon?
That's correct. We applied for funding out of the 2010 federal obligation for their high-speed rail program and were awarded this grant.
Last question on the money part.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when did we decide that we were going to put our part in, the half, the 5.8 that Oregon's putting in? Was that done a couple of years ago? I don't recall. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was. I believe it was last year. I would have to find out the specific date.
And I apologize again.
You're fine. Keep going.
Mr. Chair. So if we don't get the federal money, but you're pretty sure we're going to get it, so this is not, we're just waiting is what it amounts
correct
to. Thank you.
Is the, I'm curious, especially having, you know, ridden high-speed rail in Europe and in China and Taiwan, I mean, they're, in terms of public process, they're just on the other end of the spectrum where we are completely lacking any public process. But there's obviously an upside to that for them in terms of speed. I'm wondering where there is a balance to be had in terms of kind of going through this process focused on issues like alignment, focused on issues like the long-term investment. Hopefully the federal government at some point in time will actually step up and start making major investments in transportation again. Hope springs eternal. But I'm wondering if there is a way to try and short-circuit, for lack of a better term, some of the places, because there are obviously certain places where we consistently run into problems on the passenger lines that get at the issues Representative Nathanson was talking about in terms of reliability. And I'm wondering if there is a way, it seems like a couple of pieces of those have probably been picked up in Connect Oregon rounds, in terms of adding sidings in particular areas or some other things, but is there any way in the midst of this process to be identified, as opposed to waiting until all the way to the end of the process to doing anything?
Yeah.
Is there a way to push kind of the long term, more major, comprehensive investments to the end, but be able to pull out in the middle of the process, you know, here's a place where a siding would make a key difference in terms of schedule reliability, or here's a place where straightening out a key turn would make a key difference in terms of speed. Is there a way to have some of the benefits of what they've done in other places, which have obviously just been game changers in terms of high-speed passenger rail in those places?
To Chair Hunt, the answer is yes. There's been significant work already with UP on just those types of projects that have direct benefit to the public. And that comes in the form of being able to get more tons of freight to the ports faster, which allows us to move more freight within the I-5 corridor, but also in terms of the passenger rail improvements to date and being able to move more reliably, which I think is what Representative Nathanson was getting at. However, there are opportunities right now with UP and Amtrak to look at whether there are any potential ways to improve the existing service that we have. And that is definitely something we will continue to have conversations with them to make sure that we take advantage of the fact that there is so much interest and demand in passenger rail right now within the Valley.
Yeah, Co-Chair Hunt, we also have several smaller projects that we're currently working on that we got funding from FRA to do, including some improvements to crossovers, switches in the North Portland area, and straightening out some curves that will allow the freight trains and the passenger trains to more quickly move through areas that are currently congested. We have a couple of projects we're working on at Union Station in Portland, and we'll also be putting in a layover track at the Eugene Station, which will allow the passenger trains to spend the night at this layover track next to the station. Currently, we have to travel them several miles north into the yard in Eugene. So we are working on several other projects to do just exactly what you asked.
That I think that would be really helpful to get in terms of reports, either in writing or later on during the interim to this committee. Because I think the more we can show the public, yes, we're doing long-term comprehensive planning, mm-hmm. but we're also taking advantage of kind of the no-brainer opportunities along the way, whether they're FRA funded or whether they're Connect Oregon funded or whether there's other funding opportunities that that may not be obvious.
Yeah, and we do have several other projects we're doing through Connect Oregon. I'm just not as familiar with those as, sure. as the ones I mentioned.
Our neighbor to the north has definitely taken that approach with what they call an incremental approach to building towards the vision and trying to increase reliability, decrease travel time.
Mm-hmm. Representative Shin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand Washington got a really large federal grant for this, but I don't know anything about the actual plan. Is this is this project here designed to tie into that so that we have the continuity? I assume so, but I thought I should ask the question.
Co-Chair's Representative Sheehan, yes. The state of Washington was able to, they have more flexibility in their taxation for roads and other modes of transportation. They were able to divert money earlier to put the plan together. Once you have the plan together and it's been approved by FRA, then you are eligible for the bigger grants because you have the plan. So, yes, they were able to take advantage of two things. One, they had a plan, and second, that they have a match.
So, but ideally, we could have a high-speed rail line that went from Eugene to Vancouver, British Columbia.
Yes.
Okay. That's good. Thanks.
Representative Nivens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was really pleased. How many years ago, 10 maybe more years ago, when the federal government designated the nearly 500-mile stretch that you just described as the Cascade Corridor. It is an official federally designated Pacific Northwest corridor. So it's I think we're not talking about pie in the sky. We're talking about something that's an adopted concept mm-hmm. and recognized. So I'm very pleased about that. I wanted to ask about one other kind of project, speaking of incremental projects that help in the short term as well as the long term. What do we know about separated grade crossings and how often those are suggested for inclusion in a project list, like Connect Oregon or some other project list, whether it's rural areas or urban areas? We know that when you have an at-grade crossing, that there are sometimes speed and certainly safety issues. Now, it costs money to create a separated grade crossing, to have either the road or the track. One goes under the other, but it's going to be essential in the future. Have we done separated grade crossings with public funding recently? Are they on the list in any areas?
Chairman and representatives, I don't know the answer to that, but I can find that out for you and get back to you.
That would be a specific rail division work through with the private entities of how that would carry forward. But I think obviously the issue is the cost that you brought up, the cost for the benefit gained. And if there's an increase in travel time, a decrease in travel time and an increase in safety, then it might be worth it.
Thank you.
Mr. Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And three of us up here enjoyed riding the bullet train from Beijing out to Tianjin and back. Very interesting, 200 miles an hour, more or less. Huge cost, an unbelievable cost. And I think the folks I spoke to there indicated they never anticipated to get that cost back from the standpoint of those paying to ride the rail. The question here is, we're going to invest $10 million in this study. How much of it, and you may have said this earlier, will inure to the benefit of freight? Just of necessity. And have you been able to break that out yet?
Because we haven't actually opened, we haven't asked the question, how do we solve this problem? We don't know yet either what the improvements are or to what they'll benefit, passenger rail versus freight. I think it's safe to say at the beginning of this process that any improvements that are made to the track are likely to improve both passenger service and freight service by creating more capacity, by eliminating bottlenecks, that they're going to accomplish both those purposes. But how that's balanced really depends on ultimately what the public says about the problem we're trying to solve. So that's, it's, I think, as direct an answer as I can give you at this point.
So if I could follow up on that, just give you a sense of where the 100 stakeholders were on this question of high speed, because you brought up high speed. When the conversation happened with these 100 stakeholders, it became very obvious to the interviewers that high speed was very scary and costly to a lot of people. And when they said, well, what about higher speed? They said higher than high. That was even more scary. So I think if you look at, you know, the folks in the corridor have reasonable expectations of what they're trying to accomplish. We just haven't got them to the table to ask them what those definitive goals are and what they're trying to accomplish. But I think when you just look at their reaction in typical Oregon, you know, well, hold on. You know, 200, 225 miles an hour seems a little out of scale. So we're going to have to see where they land based on costs and based on expectations of economic development.
I think that's the first time I've heard Oregon referenced. I'm just wondering what, if we're comparing to Washington, are they much less commonsensical? I'm just curious about why the references to Oregon, just being harsh. I want the common sense approach. That's why I'm wondering, mm-hmm. One might look at what the cost of whatever it is we're going to do, the ultimate cost, and ask, where's that money coming from? Well, at least we have $10 million, so let's get the most out of it. Mm-hmm. That would be the commonsensical approach, unlike Washington, I'll say. Or maybe not.
D.C. or state?
State.
Okay.
Or both. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for this panel? One other thing I'd just note for the record, Representative Nathanson inadvertently left off the most important station on the passenger line, which is the Oregon City Station. So I know that was purely by accidental omission, but I just wanted to correct the record. We appreciate you all being here.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we'll transition to, started to talk a little bit about the funding components, but we'll broaden the discussion a little bit and move into talking about more broadly non-highway transportation funding. So, Lynn, you're staying.
Yep.
I'm being joined by Michael.
Good morning, co-chairs and committee members. I just want to kick off again. This is Lynn Peterson. A general quick discussion of where we are. As you will recall, there was quite a success in the 2009 legislative session with the Jobs and Transportation Act. Leading up to that, there's a lot of work on the Oregon Transportation Plan, updating that and looking at needs analysis, as well as policies to make things more efficient, to look at least cost planning, governance issues, and the whole transportation system was under discussion at that time. Leading up into the legislative session, several large issues were dealt with and funding was dealt with in terms of an increase in the gas tax to provide maintenance and capital for road projects throughout the state. This is really the phase two discussion of the Jobs and Transportation Act. It's the second act, so to speak. There's still quite a bit of the transportation system that needs funding. What this is looking at, we have partnered with, we actually got a Rockefeller grant to do this work through Smart Growth America, and they have been working on bringing together experts, as well as we brought on Oregon Consensus Center, and this is Michael Mills from Oregon Consensus, and he's going to walk through the process that we're in right now. But what I wanted to just make sure that you understood is that we're looking at marine, air, rail, transit, and bike and ped as the non-roadway transportation definition at this point. We've included all of those modes in because there are all still significant needs, and we have updated those, and we can quickly go through those with you. It's all in your packet. You each have a folder with both the needs assessment that Victor Dodier from ODOT did a great job updating the numbers for us on the non-roadway side, so you have that in your packet, and you also have the PowerPoint presentation from the consultants of all of the ideas that have been generated by the committee. And the committee is a small committee of 46 stakeholders. which Oregon Consensus is doing a good job facilitating and herding us to get to an actual proposal. So I'll kick it off to Michael.
Thanks, Lynn. Again, I'm Michael Mills from Oregon Consensus. Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt, and thank you, Co-Chair Bentz, for inviting us and initiating this, and thank you, Co-Vice Chair Sheehan and representatives. The Oregon Non-Roadway Transportation Funding Working Group was convened on November 7th by Governor Kitzhaber to engage the state, transportation providers, and other stakeholders in developing and implementing a plan to establish dedicated funding for non-roadway transportation projects and programs, including rail, marine, aviation, transit, on- and off-road, bicycle, and pedestrian paths. The working group's process is in part funded by Smart Growth America through the Rockefeller Foundation grant and Oregon Consensus as the legislatively created program for collaborative governance is actually managing the facilitation. Senator Lee Beyer and Pendleton Mayor Phil Hauck were selected as the co-conveners of the process by the governor. Diverse group of over 40, 46 actually stakeholders, and that's in your green peachy as the members there. They're leaders from all over the state, and they've been called upon to present funding ideas and develop criteria to develop and prioritize options for the legislature to review. The working group gathered for their second meeting on January 30th in Salem to obtain additional information, ask questions, and provide feedback. They learned that unmet needs for non-roadway transportation are estimated to be between $506 and $564 million per year. Members then proceeded to provide additional input in order to sort and narrow the funding options. So that's the process that is ongoing now. And the final group meeting is scheduled for April 5th. So this is a relatively short project in terms of coming up with recommendations that will eventually end up before the legislature. In your packet, there's a summary sheet with an update as well as the roster and the two PowerPoint presentations. There's also contact information links available too, so there's still an opportunity for you to provide input if you'd like in terms of the priorities and criteria used for ranking these different proposals. There's over 60 recommendations that have been made so far. Some are short-term, some are long-term, some are issues that will be sorted in terms of local options. There's some things that the local governments can do on their own, some with, some without legislative enabling legislation. So this will all be sorted out in the final month here that we're putting together the final options and priorities. So with that, happy to answer any questions that you have.
And if I could just follow up, in the PowerPoint presentation that has at the top non-roadway transportation funding meeting number 2, universe of options, what you'll see in there on page 4 is a quick summary of the 5 different ways that the 62 brainstormed ideas from this group have been categorized. There's the general income consumption taxes, activity-based user fees, administrative fees, fines, a value capture area discussion, and a joint participation public-private partnerships. Obviously, there is no way that all 62 would ever move forward. Some of these ideas have political overtones that realities. There's a lot of discussion, of course. Sales tax is always something that's put on the table, but you will see after the 62 ideas and their categorization, there's a ranking process that is undertaken right now. And those proposed ranking criteria, which is something that we also would love to have input on if we have missed something, is does it raise enough money to cover the needs or part of the needs or the state role? Is it easy to implement and administer? How does it affect the broader economy? Are there costs and benefits? Is there public support? And any others that are going to be suggested. So we are going to go through a ranking process. The top tier is, there'll be a top, a medium, and a low tier. And some of them might just get kicked out because they just aren't realistic. So we're in that process right now. the last meeting of the group will be to formally go through those top rankings and make sure that that's actually what the group wanted to do, because there's going to be some polling. Because there's so many people, we have to actually go through a polling process online and then make sure that they are in agreement with that, any caveats, and any other policies that might help them be more cost efficient as well. So that's where we are with the process. I would heartily invite you to let Michael or I know if you have any other ideas that need to be included for the ranking, or if you have any other ideas for criteria at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually do have, I've been asking this question several times throughout the course of the committee, and looking at the task force, you might be the most adequately prepared to answer it. Everybody has a car, so everybody is an expert in transportation value. And
they're all
a
traffic engineer.
So I'm envisioning some type of ranking system where we can make our transportation investments based on the economic value of specific things. So I'm seeing like traded sector and talent sector, where talent sector we look at pedestrian, bicycle, mass transit, and automobile, and then in the traded sector we look at marine, air, rail, and freight, and look at what the economic value of each of those is for every dollar invested in that infrastructure, and see what so we can make those decisions and have some defense of saying yes, we need to add bike lanes here because the economic value. Is that something that's currently underway with this? It sounds like by your smile it might be.
Co-chairs and Representative Sheehan, that was actually a proposal that was put forward in the 2009 legislative session, and it's what ODOT has been working on to implement the legislative direction of lease.
It was a great idea.
It's an awesome idea. Lease cost planning is what it's been called. And there's a stakeholder group called the STIP stakeholder group that I was on before I was in this position, that's been doing some really great work looking at, and this is coming out of the utility world, this kind of methodology, looking at what are all of the performance-based outcomes that you'd want to look at, both in the planning process and the project level. So in the big planning process, how do you weigh these different multimodal options to get the biggest bang for the buck on a series of different measures? And it might not get at all of the measures that you just mentioned, but it would be, you know, worth an update. But also at the project level, what's the right mix at the project level? And how do you make sure that all the way through you're maximizing for the amount of money that you're putting in?
So do you have that? Is that finished or is that in process?
No, look at Jerry Bohard from ODOT and ask her to come up. Yeah. Jerry's been in charge of the implementation of that lease cost planning work.
Good morning, Chair Hunt and committee members. For the record, Jerry Bohard, Interim Deputy Director, Operations for and the lease cost planning project that Lynn referred to, we're probably sometime this summer we'll have what we call a beta version of what the tool might look like. Just a little correction right now is that in the legislation it talks about both planning level and project level. So we're first looking at the planning level, see how that works, and then we'll get onto the project level. And essentially what this does is that we're trying to identify performance indicators, some of which we can what we call monetize, so we can give a value to it, some of which we will not be able to monetize, and we'll be putting a decision process that becomes part of that tool. Because one of the key things that came out of the committee is that they wanted performance indicators also that we had data, that we had information about too, so they didn't want it to be an unfunded data collection effort. So it's that balance of the question. So we'll see how this all comes out. We're actually kind of even testing the name, because it really isn't lease cost planning. We're actually testing the name and referring to it as Mosaic. The recognition that the community is going to be putting together a variety of building blocks to make decisions about their transportation investments. And so it's really, that's really the framework, is what is the transportation investment investments that a community wants to do. And primarily, we see this tool being used at more of a regional level, such as a metropolitan planning organization, a larger community, say like a city of Portland, a key corridor, you know, maybe Highway 97, you know, maybe a long stretch along US 26. So those are all the things that we're working on right now. We actually hope this summer we'll have a guidance document out for those that will use the tool, and then we'll be figuring out what's the project that we're going to test this on. So.
And so is this more of a survey of what people want, or I'm more interested in finding out the person who rides their bike to work and you know, she's an engineer and makes $150,000 a year versus the person who drives their car in and they have some other job where they make $35,000 a year. I want to really see the economic impact of what each one of those modes is at getting these people to whatever work they do and the so we can balance that with the economic impact.
So, Co-Chair Hunt and Representative, so the way this will work is that on those that we can monetize, so a community, or let's just say an MPO, they'll be looking at a suite of what we call a suite of actions, which could be highway projects, which could be improvements to transit, which could be improvements to light rail or improvements to bike lane, whatever it may be. And so these performance indicators will be measuring those. Where it becomes a little bit tricky is in the areas that we can't put a financial number to it, the elected official who's overseeing this effort, they're going to have to place a value on some of these quality of life points. And so the recognition that, you know, community X is going to place perhaps a different value than community Y. And so there is going to be some of that flexibility in here as we go through the tool. Because you can't monetize everything. That's basically what we're finding. And I think ultimately where you'd like to get to.
Where I'd like
to monetize everything.
But you're closer than anybody else so far. So thank you.
Yeah.
Just to follow up, though, what you're recognizing and what I think the field of transportation is finally coming to the conclusion is there are different markets within the demand for transportation. It's not a homogeneous demand. And what have never really been able to break down over the years is what the demand is within each category and the range of demand. A trip is a trip is a trip. And we've never been able to get down to that kind of specificity, but there's definitely a recognition within the transportation realm that we need to start moving in that direction because not everybody will take a transit trip, but there are a lot of people. And how do we define that based on where they live, where they work, what their income is, how many cars they own, you know, all of those demographics, and break that down and really dissect what that demand is.
Thank you.
Other questions for these folks? I would note, Co-Chair Benz, that there's one revenue source that even Idaho has taken advantage of on here that Oregon's not. I never thought I'd see a list that included that.
What page are you on?
That's on page 5.
Is it wolf hunting?
No, it's not wolf hunting, although that's an idea. I think I am struck looking down this list.
Got more tags than us.
I think, I mean, anytime you're looking at a potential fee revenue source list, I think it's always really scary for elected officials. But I think I'm still struck, for those of us who were here in 2009, and I think there was a lot of very legitimate fear about, you know, what would voter backlash be by voting for, as you said, gas taxes, vehicle registration fees, etc. And, I mean, my colleagues who are up here who took that vote can feel free to disagree, but I was completely shocked at how completely lacking the blowback was from folks after the fact. I mean, it's really amazing to me as you know, as challenging as something like a gas tax looks in a poll, when you actually say, here's the increased tax, here's the specific projects we're going to deliver. I've really been struck in the intervening 3 years by how completely lacking the negative feedback has been. Co-Chair Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would point out that one of the reasons I think that tax was accepted is that half of that money went back to local communities.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think I've heard a great deal of support for that tax because it came back locally and was then spent locally, and also that combined with the dramatic increase in the cost of asphalt and all oil-related road products made that almost a necessity. Oddly enough, the other part of it was less well received but understood because, of course, there were specific projects. But there's no doubt about that local element being hugely important in supporting that particular tax.
We appreciate all being here. Thanks for the update. We look forward to more good things to come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? Everyone who's testified?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the order, colleagues?
Is this our last meeting for the session?
Well, that's a good question.
I think we committee staff have been kind of noticing that nobody's scheduling meetings for next week for fear of being trampled by potential sine die.
Sine die doesn't seem as imminent as it might.
No, well, it did. It was seeming imminent.
Well, if be watching your schedules, but this may well be our last meeting for this session.
We're meeting the three of us.
Great.
So we can further discuss that.
So definitely continue to watch your schedule. I would continue to leave this time blocked on your schedule for Monday and Wednesday and Thursday because who knows, we may still be around for a while. I think we wanted to take as much advantage of all of us being here to begin to deal with the issues that we're going to need to deal with for the rest of the interim.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Have a good rest of the day.
I did want to thank all of you for being here. We really do appreciate it a lot.
Mm-hmm. We're adjourned.